This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The pace of news out of Washington just keeps accelerating, or at least that's the way it seems. President Trump has stepped up his promises to use tariffs, especially against China, to protect the American economy. The impact of those policies raises lots of questions for certain core elements in the Trump base, as well as potential costs of consumer goods for everyone. Immigration policy remains front and center as the president declared DACA dead and is preparing to send the National Guard to the Mexican border. In an administration that has already left lots of slots unfilled, the Veterans Affairs Secretary was ousted via Twitter, and several other cabinet members and top advisors find themselves teetering on the edge. Fortunately, we have political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson with us today to make sense of all of these currents. Welcome, Howard and Ken.
Thank you, sir.
Ken,
Did you say to make sense of everything that's going on? Yeah. Did you really say that?
Yeah, I just said it. I mean, I'm trusting you guys. You know, it's fun.
That's right. That's what.
Dan,
we'll
it's great to meet you, and Howard, it's great to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you.
Ken,
even though I can't.
Yeah, it's radio. It's a problem. Let's get started because this is the traditional way of you giving us a trivia question, which Howard almost always gets wrong.
Yeah. You know something? Yeah, I know on. Howard. I've sat next to Howard during some of these trivia questions. He has the answer written down before I finish giving the question, which is pretty remarkable. But anyway, this week's question, this question is, of course, you know, there are many members of Congress who are not seeking re-election this year, and a lot of them have resigned for a whole bunch of reasons, including two senators this year alone, Al Franken and Thad Cochran, two senators who have resigned since January 1st. But the trivia question is, who was the last Ohio senator to have resigned?
Okay, who's the last Ohio senator to have resigned midterm, in the midst of their term? Okay.
That's correct.
The person with the right answer will get a coveted Ken Rudin political junkie button that he can wear proudly at family events and other things. And if you think you know the answer, call us at 513-419-7100. So just to get us started here, let's start with tariffs. The president, we know, hates trade deficits, has been talking about imposing tariffs throughout the campaign and into his administration. And the question I really don't know how to get a handle on, Ken, is to what extent is this a strategy? Does he understand, you know, by announcing these relatively large tariffs against China, is he just laying that out so he can then negotiate? Or is he just laying it out there and saying, this is what we're going to do?
Well, yeah, actually, that's a great question. And the fact is, we always seem to criticize Donald Trump for flip-flopping on issues throughout his career. Trade and tariffs is one thing that he has been on the same side, has not changed for years. He's always felt that the U.S. has been taken advantage of in trade deals by other countries, and he did this well before he was a presidential candidate. He's long said that. Having said that, though, there are consequences to instituting a trade war. So by leveling tariffs against Chinese goods, you know that China is going to respond, and China has responded with tariffs against American goods. And of course, you know, for in many cases, the American consumer will pay the price, U.S. manufacturers will pay the price, and Republicans don't know what to do with it because Republicans are the fair trade, the free trade kind of party, as opposed to Democrats that seem to like tariffs. So whether he understands the ramifications of what a trade war would mean is unanswerable at this point. But the point is, often Donald Trump goes by gut, and his gut tells him that the U.S. has been taken advantage of, and it's up to institution of tariffs that'll make things all right.
And the ramifications are particularly great for American consumers. I mean, I can look around this room and probably find 20 different items that were made in China.
interested.
Although Trump realizing what he's getting involved in, it seems like Larry Kudlow, his new trade guy, has said, well, it won't include shoes, it won't include clothes, yeah. It won't include smartphones. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of seems to be, you know, there's always exceptions. You know, the Trump administration was going to have this drilling off the coast, the East Coast of the United States for oil. And then he says, well, I'm not going to do it in Florida because Rick Scott is running for the Senate there and it could hurt his campaign. So he always seems to make exceptions. He seems to have made exceptions, or at least Larry Kudlow made exceptions with these kind of deals like smartphones from China to protect the American taxpayers and the American consumers.
I think there's another way, though, of seeing that comment by Larry Kudlow, which is, here's a brand new member of the Trump administration. Is this an early indication that we've got another important advisor who's on a different path than the president and they're not in sync?
Well, they were never in sync on this issue, because for all the things that Donald Trump saw in Larry Kudlow to be his top economic advisor, they were never on the same page of tariffs. Larry Kudlow was always against tariffs, for free trade, as are many Republican conservatives. So they were on different sides on this issue from the beginning. And it was interesting because the previous top economic advisor quit over the tariff issue, or at least that's one of the reasons he gave for quitting. Larry Kudlow has the same anti-tariff point of view as his predecessor, but we'll see if there's that disagreement becomes too tough for the two of them to sit down and agree on in future negotiations.
This seems to be a pattern, though, that Trump will come out with these very big, grand plans. And then members of his administration start walking them back. You know, they start saying, "Okay, let's well, not shoes, not phones, not this." You know, and this seems to be a pattern.
I'm not sure if that's true, because I think, if, for example, when Trump's rhetoric about North Korea and said that diplomacy is not going to work, and Rex Tillerson is out in Beijing or somewhere saying that we've got to dial back this rhetoric, and Trump stayed strong about it, saying, Rex, you're wasting your time by talking about diplomacy. We got to beat this little rocket man, things like that. So often, I think it's pretty rare that the administration ramps back its rhetoric. They seem to have when it comes to tariffs. So.
Well, Trump does not. But I'm talking about, you know, some of the people that come in, the Kudlows and the Tillersons and others who come back and say, wait a minute, you know.
And that raises an interesting question, too. I mean, at the very time that the president is preparing for a summit with Kim Jong-un, and we need China, I would think we need China in sort of geopolitical terms, we're hitting China hard with a lot of tariffs. It seems to me that, you know, are you syncing up the trade policy with the negotiations policy on nuclear weapons in North Korea?
And who did China have as a special guest a couple of weeks ago in Beijing, right? So it was It was Kim Jong-un. So it's an interesting it seems like the president doesn't always seem to realize the consequences of some of his actions. But sometimes either he's stubborn or convinced he's right. But sometimes he'll just stay true to what he believes in and, you know, let the facts and logic be damned.
Well, aren't some Republican leaders pushing back on this tariff policy?
On tariffs, yes. On most policies, no. But on tariffs, yes. Either they're quiet about it, like Mitch McConnell. Who knows what Mitch McConnell is thinking, but the Senate Majority Leader is very, very, very reluctant to criticize the president either in private or outright. There are a bunch of Republicans who say that, you know, this is not the kind of trade policy that is, you know, the Republican Party believes in. But, you know, other than Paul Ryan and some things saying, well, this is may not be the right way to do it, I don't know if I don't think there's going to be. Look, this is the president's policy, and it's, you know, whether the Republican Party goes along with it or not. I think it's fascinating when you have Sherrod Brown, for example, standing up and saying, I love the president's policy on tariffs and NAFTA and things like that. And Jim Renacci saying, well, I don't know about that. It just puts this is what the brilliance of Donald Trump is, that he just confuses ideologies and confuses the parties, and he's his own. He's his own trade negotiator. He's his own Secretary of State. And the other parties, members of both parties, have to act accordingly.
And you're absolutely right about Sherrod Brown, because Sherrod Brown and Donald Trump, in Ohio at least, share a common group of voters who are, you know, very much in favor.
In the manufacturing sector?
Yeah.
So, but what does this mean? I mean, you can talk about – there's been a lot of reporting about what this might mean for the Trump core vote and a lot of focus on farmers and the agricultural sector. But what's it mean for ordinary people, people who might live in Cincinnati, not involved directly in agriculture? And because one of the arguments has been for a long time that in this long-term period that we've had of stagnant salary growth, one of the few things that people have gotten is holding down the cost of goods because we've outsourced so much of this and we've held the cost down. That's the way people have actually benefited from in this long stagnation period.
Yeah, I mean, my gut tells me that any kind of trade war like this, the consumer will ultimately have to be paying more for goods coming from overseas, and there's no two ways about it. But at the same time, Trump's policies have, I mean, it seems to be some indication around the country, I think Ohio as well, but around the country, that some steel mills who were thought, you know, dead and buried a long time ago seem to be either reopening or hiring. And that is a part of the Trump's trade policies and economic policies as well. So there's no, you know, there's no black or white about what Trump is doing. I think the tariff policy could ultimately hurt people. Other things about, you know, instituting tariffs on steel and aluminum could help the domestic steel industry, which could create more jobs as well. So it's a mixed bag, I think, in this whole thing.
Well, just before we take a break here, Ken, I'd like for you to repeat your question, the trivia question today. We do have some people lined up, but if you'll repeat that question so that when we come back from our break, people can weigh in on that.
Well, with all the members of Congress who have have resigned already this last year and this year, two senators have already resigned this year. The question is, who was the last Ohio senator to have resigned his or her office? Well, actually, I can't say her office because Ohio's never had a female senator, has it?
No.
No, it hasn't. So, okay, who the last Ohio senator to have resigned his office?
Okay. That narrows it down to all senators who have ever served out
of
Ohio.
We had a female governor for 11 days.
Yeah. That's right.
Nancy
That's right.
Hollister. Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you've got an answer to Ken's question, call 513-419-7100. Let's start out with Jeff. And Jeff, I understand you have an answer.
Yeah, that's correct. Is it Howard Metzenbaum?
Ken, is it Howard Metzenbaum?
No, Howard Metzenbaum actually served until his retirement in, I guess, 1994.
Yes.
He didn't resign midterm.
Okay, sorry about that. Now we go to Suzanne. And Suzanne, I think you have an answer.
I do. I'm guessing Robert Taft Jr.
Robert Taft Jr.
No, Robert Taft Jr. actually was defeated for re-election. Howard Metzenbaum beat him in 1976, so he didn't resign midway. He was defeated in his bid for a second term in 76.
Okay. One more try here that I know of. Robert, I think you have a, shall we say, an answer or a guess?
I believe it's the answer.
Okay.
Okay.
It's William Saxby.
Ken, what do you say to that?
William Saxby happens to be the correct answer.
There you go. And I will confirm right now that Howard wrote down the correct answer as you gave him the question. Yes, what a shock.
What a shock.
So
William Saxby, just quickly, William Saxby elected senator in 1968. Just before he was going to retire in 74, he resigned his seat to become Richard Nixon's attorney general. His previous attorney general was canned in the wake of the Saturday Night Massacre. Saxby resigned in 74 to become Nixon's attorney general.
Okay. Well, Robert, stay on the line so that the producer can get your information and know where to send you that incredibly valuable political
book. Very good, Robert. Good job.
All right. Thank you. Now, back to our discussion. There are growing sort of indications that even some of the leadership of the Republican Party is worried about and speaking out about possible midterm election problems. So, you know, the Democrats have been able to win in Alabama in the Senate, special election in Pennsylvania. There's one coming up in Arizona that that should be safe, but it's not. And last week, a special election for state's Supreme Court in Wisconsin went to a Democrat. Mitch McConnell has compared this to a possible hurricane. He says, not sure if it's going to be a 3, 4, or 5. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has warned of a blue wave. How nervous are Republicans getting at this point?
I think they are nervous, and I think they have a right to be nervous. You know, Dan, you mentioned the elections that went the Democrats' way. The Democrats did much better than anyone expected in Virginia last year. They won the special election in Alabama for the Senate seat. Of course, Rory Moore didn't help the Republican cause. They won the special congressional election in Southwest Pennsylvania, the district that Donald Trump carried by 20 percentage points in 2016. The Democratic enthusiasm seems to be up. A Republican seems to be more discouraged than before. And there seems to be indications that, and especially in not only the elections I just mentioned, but you mentioned a judgeship or state legislative races around the country, Democrats have done very well, if not won a lot of Republican seats since the 2016 election. So, you know, Mitch McConnell's talking about the hurricanes, and Charlie Dent, the retiring Republican congressman from Pennsylvania, talked about a tidal wave, and if I were you, I'd get off the beach quickly. Jeff Flake, the Republican senator from Arizona, said this could be a disaster. And it could be. I mean, look, who knows? We would be very wrong to be predicting something in April for what's going to happen in November, because things can change on a dime. Look, the day of the 2016 election, very few people predicted Donald Trump would win. And if you can't predict it the day of the election, I'm not going to predict something, you know, 6, 7, 8 months down the line. But having said that, the numbers don't look good for the Republicans. They seem to be, and it's not so much the Trump policies. It's not that he's too conservative or he's doing what he said he would do. Look, he said he would do whatever he can to protect the border. He said he would fight for, you know, better jobs and a better economy. But it's the personal stuff. It's the invective, the tweets, the temper tantrums, the bullying, the comments about women and Muslims and John McCain and fellow Republicans. So there's a feeling, though, that
questions.
Yeah, no. I mean, all of these Democrats in these districts and in these Senate races are running against Trump, and they're running against their Democratic opponents or their Republican opponents for being too closely tied to Trump. It's all about Donald Trump, and Mitch McConnell is obviously not stupid. He knows it's a 51-49 edge that he's got, and that on Paul Ryan's side, they only have to flip 24 seats. I never thought I would live to see the day in Ohio when Ohio's first congressional district, held by Steve Chabot since 1994, except for 2 years,
right,
would be targeted by the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. It's targeted now. And his opponent, who started on January 31st, has already raised like $660,000. I mean, it's amazing. I never thought I'd see this.
So, what's the Republican leadership, if they're really worried about this, the Republican congressional leadership, what do they have to do, and how quick do they have to do something?
Well, time is getting late, and obviously, let me just one addendum to what Howard just said. One size doesn't fit all for the Democratic Party, because you talked about that a lot of the Democrats are running against Trump. Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania's 18th district didn't run against Trump.
Didn't mention
As a matter of fact, he basically ran against Nancy Pelosi. So obviously, Democrats are going to pick and choose who their enemies are, what the strategy is, depending on the district. But right now, I think if you run against Trump and that's your sole argument, you're in big trouble, because I think voters know how they feel about Donald Trump. They want something to be done about the economy, about military, foreign affairs, jobs at home, things like that, healthcare and things like that. So if you just say Trump needs to be impeached and that's your answer, I don't think that's going to help the Democratic Party. I think you need to come up with solutions. There are a lot of people who felt that Hillary Clinton didn't. Now, I disagree with this point of view, but there are a lot of people who felt that Hillary Clinton was just running an anti-Trump campaign and not offering alternatives. And I think she did, but I think the perception among many voters is that she did not. So you have to have something to say, and I think that's what Democrats have to remember. Don't just look at the Trump numbers that show him at 38, 39, 40%. Decide what voters are looking for and then respond accordingly, because they still have the wind at their sails. They still have momentum. They still have the enthusiasm among Democratic voters. That's something they don't want to lose when it comes to November.
Howard, what do you think?
Well, and in Ohio's first congressional district, this Aftab Perival, this new kid on the block, he is running against Trump. He's trying to tie Shabbat to Trump, but that's not all he's doing. He's kind of running against Steve Shabbat as a do-nothing guy, a guy who's really never produced anything, is a no vote on a lot of issues that are important to people, somebody who's opposed food programs for kids in schools. I mean, and it's not just you can't just do it on Trump. It's like Ken says, you got to tailor your message to the district that you're running in or the state that you're running in.
But it seems to me that the Republican leadership also has to tailor a message that says, this is where we're headed.
Well, but in this case, in this Ohio First District, their only message so far is, well, this is a kid and he's not experienced. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
Except he blew him out in a local
election.
Well, we have a question from Bob. And, Bob, I want to get you on so that you can ask your question. Go ahead. Bob, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Can you hear?
Yes, sir.
Hi. I've been watching the media for some mention of this, and I wondered if anybody had heard this. But the Trump administration has been denying global warming. They incentivize coal. They put tariffs on solar. And who's the big beneficiary? If you look around the world at what nations would benefit, it's Russia. They're farther north than Russia is farther north than the northern edge of Minnesota. And I think that global warming would actually benefit their economy.
Ken, do you want to respond?
I've never heard the argument. I mean, this is the first time I've ever heard this. I've never heard the argument that denying climate change is the purpose of that is to benefit Russia. That I haven't heard. But it's clear that everywhere from EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt on down, that there is a sense that science, or at least accepted science, doesn't seem to matter, that all these Obama regulations on the environment and protection and regulation, things like that, are not nearly as important as business success. And so I kind of think that a lot of the opposition to climate change is really based on helping businesses out and getting rid of these regulations. So, I mean, Russia is a different angle. And, of course, of those who think that Trump is in the pocket of the Russians, this becomes an interesting argument. But I kind of think that the the argument that Scott Pruitt and Trump are doing is really get rid of these regulations, get rid of environmental controls. And that's, to me, it's very short-sighted, because I think most scientists will agree, regardless of politics, that climate change is real. But I think that those in the administration don't see it that way at all, or at least they don't care about it at all.
But Bob, yeah, I think it's more for the benefit of American business than it is for Russia.
Yeah. Now, one thing though that it seems to me that's possible here is that, tying back to what we were just talking about, one of the reasons that the Republican leadership hasn't taken a stance, or more stances, multiple, to Trump, is they may not like his style, as Howard was saying, and they may be uncomfortable with, you know, communicating by Twitter and all of that kind of stuff. But they're getting a lot of what they want. They're getting the tax change. They got the Supreme Court justice. They got a lot of regulations killed by presidential order. So the point is, even though they may be uncomfortable with certain things, a lot of the Republican agenda is getting put in place.
There is truth to that, and it fascinates me that, by most accounts, the economy is doing well and continuing to do well, and the stock market is, while it fluctuates a lot, it's still much higher than it was when Trump took office. The fact that the economy is doing well and the president's numbers are still hovering around 40% makes me think it's less about ideology and much more about personality. But also, one reason why Republicans are hesitant to take on Trump, even if it's only about personality and temper and temperament and things like that, is that his base, the Republican base, still is loyal to President Trump. And if you're a Jeff Flake or a Bob Corker or somebody like that who decides that they don't like what the president's doing and you want to take him on, you get clobbered back home. The reason Jeff Flake is not running for re-election in Arizona is because his numbers have tanked the moment he wrote this anti-Trump book. Bob Corker in Tennessee was a strong critic of Trump. He tried to run again, change his mind to run again, and the Republicans said, no, you had your chance, and you'll get defeated by a pro-Trump conservative in the primary, so he's out as well. I think every time you decide you want to take on the president because of his lack of intolerance, because of his bullying, because of whatever complaints you have about him, you have to realize that you're going to be faced with a challenge from the Trump group of Republican voters who have stayed loyal to him.
Yeah, it's very clear that none of the stuff, I mean, not Stormy Daniels, not anybody, nothing has shaken these people's resolve in supporting Donald Trump. They would vote for him again.
There's a lot of anger about what existed.
Yeah.
But isn't it interesting, though, that if you take a poll of almost everybody I know, they say they believe a porn star, they believe the word of a porn star over the president of the United States. That's remarkable.
Pretty remarkable.
That's surreal.
Really, yeah.
Well, there's a lot of that. I mean, I still cannot believe that he said what he said about Senator McCain way back in the beginning.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, there's a lot of things that would have tanked the typical political candidate or president, but it doesn't in this case.
It doesn't faze his supporters at all.
Let's talk a little bit. Go ahead, Ken.
Just to say one quick thing. When you think of the collapse of Rick Perry's presidential candidacy in 2012, it's because he couldn't remember the third cabinet department he was going to cut. And everybody said, oh, my God, I can't believe he said that. He's finished. If you think of all the things Donald Trump has said, from the Access Hollywood tape to the thing about women to the thing about McCain, I mean, Trump said it the best. He said, I can go on Fifth Avenue, in the middle of Fifth Avenue in New York City and shoot somebody, and my vote will not diminish at all. And there's truth to that.
Okay.
Shockingly so.
Well, in terms of that, what about Trump's relationship with his cabinet? So within the past week, he dismissed, essentially by tweet, the Veterans Affairs Secretary, David Shulkin. The HUD Secretary Ben Carson is, who knows where he stands. Chief of Staff John Kelly doesn't seem to be a lot of support. And EPA Secretary Scott Pruitt finds himself in a very difficult situation, not because of policy, but because of some scandal in terms of cozying up to a lobbyist. So what about the president's relationship to the people he has drawn in to be his closest advisors?
Well, excluding David Shulkin because he was an Obama holdover. But, I mean, when you think of, like you know, there's more of a turnover in this cabinet than any cabinet in memory, if not ever. And that's, you know, that's one thing to say against Trump. But at the same time, you want a Secretary of State to reflect your views. You want a national security advisor to reflect your views. So replacing, you know, H.R. McMaster for John Bolton makes sense. To get rid of Rex Tillerson for Mike Pompeo makes sense, because you have somebody who believes in, is on the same page as the president. But the president does seem pretty often to like the new shiny object. For one thing, you notice that a lot of his recent appointees have been people he's seen on TV, like Larry Kudlow, like people like that, and he just likes that. And two, he seems to, I'm not a psychiatrist, I only play one on WVXU, but he just seems like he likes something new, and he's entranced with it until he no longer is interested, and then he looks for something different.
I absolutely agree with that. I mean, if that were not the case, he wouldn't have had to replace all these people. He would have chosen them in the first place, and they would have still been in position. I mean, he's not been in office, but nearly 15 months. I mean, it's not really been that long.
Just before I leave that discussion, Ken, how stable, how viable is Scott Pruitt?
Well, if he does leave, I mean, of course, there's been talk about him having tremendous ambition. He's talking about perhaps running for governor of Oklahoma down the line, or the Senate seat when Jim Inhofe's seat is up in 2020. There was even a New York Times article recently that he may be even looking at a presidential race in 2024. The fact that we're talking about a presidential race in 2024 is just insane, but everything else is insane. It's not about, but he has his own personal problems. But as far as ideology, as far as style, I think the president likes him. The early mentions you mentioned were, look, David Shulkin had issues. He got free Globetrotters tickets that he shouldn't have taken. He traveled with his wife on the government's dime in Europe that he eventually paid back. Ben Carson, who is probably not qualified to be Secretary of HUD anyway. I mean, when he said, when Ben Carson was told he's going to join HUD, he said he always loved Paul Newman. And I thought that was a mistake right away. I'll explain that joke later. But Ben Carson had the issue with the tens of thousands of dollars spent on office furniture. Kelly, the chief of staff, has had a problem with the firing of some people. So these guys have had reasons to wonder about their future, and not just because of Trump impatience.
Well, we've got a couple of calls. Let's take John. And John, I think you have a question for Ken and Howard.
Yes, I do.
Go ahead.
My question is, if you guys could just tell me what you think the Republican reaction would be if Barack Obama spent days and days running down any American company, such as our president has been doing with Amazon. I just think it's ridiculous. What do you guys think?
Ken?
Well, you know exactly what he's doing with Amazon. The fact is, the reason President Trump has been attacking Amazon and the so-called tax benefits is getting, it's interesting that a president who has not released his own tax returns or his own tax information, business information, is going after another company's tax practices. But having said that, his unhappiness with Amazon is because Amazon is led by Jeff Bezos, who's the owner of the Washington Post, and the Washington Post has been a steady a critic of President Trump from the outset. So I think his attack about Amazon is ideological. I mean, John asked a very good question. If President, Obama were just attacking a company because of ideological reasons, it'd just be remarkable. And speaking of Obama, let me just, I mean, I know that I've gotten a few emails since the last show that said that I'm harder on Trump than I would have been on Obama and previous presidents. And that may be true, may not be true. And I think it's a fair conversation to have. But the president tweeted this week. He said, "Thank you to Rasmussen for the honest polling. I just hit 50%, which is higher than cheating Obama at the same time in his administration." Why cheating Obama? Why do that? Why? He's not running against Obama anymore. Right. He's not running against Hillary Clinton anymore. Why the obsession? He won the election. He is the 45th president of the United States. Why call him cheating Obama? As far as I know, Obama hasn't had three wives that he's cheated on, but I don't mean to be snarky, but it upsets me because there's no reason for it. Maybe his numbers in Rasmussen are better than Obama's, but why cheating Obama? Why lying Hillary? Why do you have to be obsessed with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, just say it. I mean, just say Rasmussen says I'm doing better. Right. Why do
better
you have
Obama,
to?
Obama, sure, and that's right. Legitimate. That's legitimate.
That's a legitimate argument. And, you know, and this name-calling and stuff, and Ken is absolutely right. This election is over. It has been over for some time.
It's the difference between politicians who love campaigning and politicians who want to govern.
Right.
And governing and campaigning are two very different things, and different people get turned on by one of the two, and how to balance those out is frequently a problem.
Well, a president never really stops campaigning in a first term, but your rhetoric changes.
Right.
You know, the way you conduct yourself changes, the way you speak in public changes, and you don't speak like a candidate anymore.
We have okay, go ahead, Ken.
I was just going to say, look, it's fair to say that Ronald Reagan, when he ran for re-election in 1984, ran as an outsider. He still wasn't the incumbent in his mind because he felt like this outsider to politics. And that's fine. But he still, Jimmy Carter failed to be an object of derision after he was elected. Reagan was elected in 1980. There was no reason for him to go after Jimmy Carter. There was no reason for Obama to attack George W. Bush or a previous Republican president. He didn't do that. There just seems to be no reason other than the fact that he's obsessed with, maybe he's obsessed with the fact that he didn't get win the popular vote, but it's just so unnecessary and childish.
That's the
end of my lecture for today.
Homily.
Yes, homily.
We have Gerald on the line, and Gerald, you have an observation question.
Yes, I was curious about you guys' take on how does the turmoil and the turnover, the constant turnover, affect domestic policy and the short notice, and also our foreign policy and also our foreign policy or influence in the long term. As in, like you just referenced, Reagan, the things he did from the Star Wars or the actions George W. Bush had actions influenced long term foreign effects. For example, how China is growing, it seems like we are become more isolationist and diminishing our influence on the foreign scale.
Ken?
That's a great question, but it's a very broad question, and you could go on for it. Like, there were so many things that popped to mind when I just heard the question. Like, for example, part of the foreign policy going on right now is President Trump, who seems to be likely to end or want to change the nuclear treaty with Iran, and he wants to tear it up. At the same time, he's trying to negotiate a treaty with North Korea, and if he has a summit with Kim, that'll be part of the conversation. If he's telling the world that I'm going to rip apart a treaty that the United States has made with Iran, what message does that send to North Korea about the word of the United States when it comes to subsequent treaties? So that's a concern as well. Donald Trump has said from the beginning that the war in Iraq was a mistake. I mean, there's a question of whether he was opposed to it from the beginning, but clearly his rhetoric as a candidate said that it was a big mistake, and he blamed the Bush family and George W. Bush, George Bush's father, Jeb Bush, all the Bushes on that ill-conceived war. war, and that's fine. But then he picks John Bolton to be his national security advisor, who was one of the biggest supporters, the biggest proponents of that war in Iraq to this day. He still says it's a good, it was a good thing. So there's a mixed message there. I think the ultimate thing is that Donald Trump is his own Secretary of State, is his own Secretary of Defense. Ultimately, he will be his own national security advisor. And a lot of it is based on whims. There is no, unlike treaty, unlike like tariffs, unlike with immigration, it seems like the president has been all over the map on foreign policy. And I guess the foreign policy establishment, as well as cabinet officials and the Justice Department, I mean, the State and Defense Departments, have to get used to it.
Well, we now have a call from Nancy. And Nancy, you have a question.
Yes, I do have a question. I want to know what Ken and Howard think about the activities of Sinclair Broadcasting. I know that the ownership is really alt-right and very aggressive with their political beliefs. And recently we've had some indication that they want that political viewpoint to be expressed on local news.
Well, Howard?
Well,
Howard, I talked a lot last time. You want to take it, Howard?
Yeah. I think with Sinclair Broadcasting, the thing that we should look at, and you know, the ownership of that organization, they can believe whatever they want. This is, it's free country, the First Amendment, and they can say whatever they want. I don't believe that it should be seeping into their news coverage, their local news coverage, because that's a different matter, and that's a product that Sinclair sells. That's that all companies which own local television stations sell basically news. That's how they make their money. And it doesn't – I worked for a very large media organization that had some strong opinions, but in Gannett, but they told all of their newspapers, look, you take whatever editorial opinion you want, whatever fits your community. Because all we really care about is that you make money for us. And they stayed out of that. They stayed out of the business of trying to control editorial pages at all their newspapers. And I think that is the model that they should adopt.
Ken, do you have anything?
I was going to say, to answer Nancy's question, I think this is part of the administration's assault on the media. I mean, from the beginning, he said that the media is the enemy of the American people, which is sounds so Stalinistic, I just can't begin to say it. He talks about the fake news and the dishonest press.
Yeah.
And every time he gives a speech somewhere, he'll almost incite the crowd to yell out some kind of a obscene chant about CNN or NBC or something like that. At the same time, the president is applauding a group like Sinclair Broadcast Group because it has been nominally pro-Trump. And Deadspin released a video. If you haven't seen it yet, you got to go to YouTube and look at it. It's basically showing all these anchors on stations around the country parroting word for word about the fake news and the fake media. And look, fake news is bad. Fake news by definition is wrong. But to see a proponent of fake news talking about other people's fake news is frightening. Go to Deadspin on YouTube. Find this video. It'll just show you what Sinclair is all about. And of course, President said Sinclair is far more reputable than CNN or NBC or anything like that.
Yeah, that video that Ken's talking about really is scary to watch.
Well, I think I have to say something that I worked for 36 years for WKRC, and over that time there were six owners. Our last owner, the current owner, is Sinclair. The only thing I'd like to add on this is that I have talked with reporters, friends of mine, colleagues in that newsroom, and on their coverage of local stories, they are not being slanted, directed as to what they should be saying. The problem with television is separating editorial from reporting is a little bit more difficult than it is in newspapers, where you have a different section, a different page in the paper. And Howard's point that each Gannett paper could follow its own community standards on editorial policy. So all I can tell you is that I cringe, but I know that reporters are maintaining their standards and their dignity, and I applaud them for that. So let's move on to immigration. And that's another big topic. We don't have a lot of time left. The president declared DACA was dead, and now he's sending National Guard troops to the border. President George W. Bush and Barack Obama both did this. Why is this any different than what his two predecessors did?
Well, for one thing, Barack Obama in 2010 sent 1,200 National Guard troops to the border to basically help things on logistics and things like that. George W. Bush sent 6,000 National Guard troops to the border in 2006, again in an advisory and supplementary role. Donald Trump is talking about sending out 100,000 National Guard troops, sending them to the border with Mexico because this caravan of Central American refugees are moving up the, you know, up Mexico, and eventually, in according to some people, is going to plot an invasion of the U.S. border. So he wants 100,000 U.S. National Guard troops there, in addition to the, you know, the tens of thousands of border troops, border guards who are already there to certify the border. Since it's, what I really think it is that part of it is frustration that the wall that he promised Mexico would build and that he wanted Congress to build, but Congress won't implement the, you know, authorize the $25 billion it would cost. He's frustrated. And if you think of his first day announcing his candidacy, when he talked about all the rapists and the drug dealers that Mexico is sending across the border, this is a key issue for Donald Trump. He's felt it very strong. He feels he's being stymied by the lack of a wall, and after 13, 14 months of his presidency. And this is just another indication that it shows that he can be tough. Can I just interrupt one thing? Because I know we have so little time, and I'm sure you guys have talked about it over the week, but the thought of yesterday being the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's death, mm-hmm. and to think of how far we've come in civil rights, or not come in civil rights in 50 years, that has haunted me and obsessed with me all week long. And to see a president talking about us versus them and immigrants and drug dealers and rapists and things like that, and Muslims who shouldn't be in the country, seems to me anathema to everything that Dr. King talked about. And again, you know, I'm sorry that we only think about this every time it's the anniversary, but it stuck with me all week long. And I just wanted to share that.
Well, Ken, I will say we started this week with a show completely devoted to the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's death and assassination. And that will be replayed on Sunday morning, and it's certainly on our website. I want to thank both Ken and Howard for a lively discussion, as I know it always is. And they'll be back, and we'll take on more issues as it comes up. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned to 91.7 for Here and Now, coming up next.